If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. Explain crypto to me like I'm a golden retriever edition. It's Wednesday, November 9th, 2022. On today's show, weird, the Al Yankovic story is a pitch-perfect biopic parody starring Daniel Radcliffe as Weird Al. And then we discuss, at last, I'm so excited, Dairy Girls, the wonderfully peculiar and endearing sitcom about a group of teens growing up in Northern Ireland during the tail end of the Troubles. It's just wrapped up its three-year run. And finally, well, when it comes to crypto, who isn't a bit of a golden retriever, right? A happy, sort of thoughtless cutie pie with a tongue lolling out of your mouth stupidly. Well, the financial writer, Nonpareil, how do you say, is that how you say that, Dana?
Francophone? Yeah, that'll do.
Ça va, monsieur. Ça va bien. All right, Nonpareil. Matt Levine, he's not a golden retriever when it comes to crypto or anything finance related. He's written the explainer to end all crypto explainers. We will discuss crypto with Matt himself. In the meantime, joining me today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello.
And Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hey.
Are we ready to make a show?
Let's do it.
Okay. The Weird Al Yankovic story is, weirdly enough, it's on Roku. It's been aptly described as a note-for-note parody of the biopic genre. It starts, accordingly, with the artist in his spiral phase, glutted on fame and abusable substances. Freeze frame, how did we get here? And we go back to the origin story, and off we go. It stars Daniel Radcliffe, who kind of swole since his Harry Potter days, a little bit of a surprise for me, and Evan Rachel Wood as Madonna. There's Al himself is in it, very funny turn as a jerky record exec. All right, in the clip we're about to hear, Al is a layabout. He's making bologna sandwiches for his three layabout roommates when the song My Sharona comes on the radio, and suddenly he's inspired. Let's listen.
Where did that come from?
Dude, I've got chills.
I don't know, it just came out of me.
I've never heard anything like that before in my life. You have to record that.
Record it? No, come on, guys.
Al, you've got something here. I don't know if it comes from God or the devil. The world needs to hear it.
No, forget it, guys. I don't have the money for a recording studio.
I think the bathroom at the bus station is pretty good acoustics.
I mean, I don't know if our producer is going to bring the volume up on our, you know, spontaneous real-time reactions to that clip, Dana, but it says it all. I think I feel like I know how you felt about this movie
just
already.
Just something about the pause between the two moments of invention of the lyrics to My Bologna. Yeah, I mean, what can you say about this movie? I feel like I don't have a ton to say that the movie doesn't already do for you. I, for one, did not at all feel like I needed another parody music biopic from anyone. As I say in my review of this movie on Slate, I felt like Walk Hard kind of did the job so well that it never needed to be redone. And I even felt that way about Popstar, the you know, Andy Samberg starring music biopic parody, which was fun, you know, but which felt a little bit like a thin extended joke. And yet somehow this movie totally captured my heart. And I think a huge part of it to me goes to, well, okay, Yankovic himself co-wrote the movie, right? So it's his spirit infusing it. And Daniel Radcliffe just brings it to this role. Like, the amount of sincere commitment that he brings to this utterly absurd fake biopic stuffed with obvious lies, and yet that still manages to have a few truly emotional moments, was kind of a wonder to witness. And I just love that it didn't take itself too seriously, and that it really enjoyed the music and gave us a lot of music. But Julia, you said you have a lot to say about this movie, unlike me. So other than just snorting at that wonderful scene with the doofus roommates, who, by the way, are some of my favorite characters, nameless, like, three dudes right. that he lives with.
Yeah, he just happens to, like, and they're just like, they just happen to play musical instruments. Like, they never mention
it. Yeah, he needs a backing band, and it just so happens he lives with a bassist, a guitarist, and a drummer. But Julia, I want to hear what flow of of insight you have about the Weird Al story.
I don't actually have very much to say other than I liked it so much over and over and over again. So I guess, you know, I went in with fairly low expectations. It didn't get the best reviews. Everyone's like, oh, it's kind of a trifle. It's on the Roku channel. What even is that? My husband and I were like running around the house, like trying to do all this like screen mirroring and like searching for the Roku app. And then I Googled it and you can just stream it on the Roku website for free. I was like, oh, this is a solvable technical problem. I would argue that this is worth watching in the walk hard pop star, never stop, never stopping lineage, because the specificity of the comedy is so Weird Al, and that's slightly different. Like, it's not making fun of the biopic genre in order to make fun of the biopic genre. It's making fun of the biopic genre in order to enact an ode to Weird Al's sensibility, which is like a different reason to make fun of the biopic genre in some ways. You know, like the thing that the film starts doing, which is having, like, it's very hard to get your head around tonally for the first 20 minutes or so, because you're like, wait, what's going to happen? There's like violent beatings in this movie. There's like boater wearing accordion salesmen. What is
teenage polka parties? Forbidden polka parties. Yes,
that may have been where
That's the first moment he sneaks out to a party. Polka is just blaring, and like the kids are rocking out to polka. And then just like his sense of humor about his shtick and the unlikeliness of his success is just so charming and adds an additional layer. You know, fundamentally, it's a Weird Al song, right? You take the story you know, and you just like swap in some different words for different parts of it to see what you can make. Like, it's his sensibility transposed onto the biopic, and it's just very, very enjoyable. I will agree with you, Dana, in your review. It's not so great on the gender front. Like, the Evan Rachel Wood's Madonna is pretty funny as a villain, but the fact that she's evil, which I didn't mind, but she's also a terrible shot, so she's incompetently evil. Like, it began to feel slightly sexist, and I wouldn't go so far as to accuse the Weird Al ethos of being fundamentally sexist, but it's a little thoughtless about gender in a way that wasn't my fave. Can you talk a little bit about that part of your review?
Yeah, I mean, that stretch is a strange thing where it would be easy to say, particularly about this kind of movie that's basically an extended comedy sketch. In fact, it literally is spinning out the director Eric Appel's own fake trailer for such a movie that he made, I don't know, a dozen years ago, right? And he's now padded it out into a full-length movie. So it's not at all unusual that those kind of movies, like an SNL movie, falls off at the end. But this movie does something slightly different. It falls off in the middle, I think, during that Madonna segment, and then springs back to life again when that subplot is over. And why that subplot doesn't work, I think, really just has to do with the character and the arc not being well thought through. It's almost accidentally sexist. I don't think it sets out to take down Madonna, certainly, or to, you know, create a femme fatale for the sake of demeaning women. It's just not really interested in exploring the nuances or psychology of that relationship. I mean, it's sort of funny to talk about psychological nuance in a movie like this, but for example, Weird Al's relationship with his roommates feels more like something we're invested in than this kind of straw woman of Madonna being created. She's this seductive femme fatale, and then she kind of gets involved with a drug cartel, and basically she is all the villainy of the movie is kind of heaped onto her almost out of just just narratological right. laziness.
It just kind of doesn't work. I agree. But even though I think she's very funny, Evan Rachel Wood is doing what she can with it and is vamping and like kind of being great.
Well, the idea that Madonna is always voguing, just even during a conversation, right. is a nice touch.
Is funny. So here's the thing. I just kept thinking, I mean, I went in thinking, I cannot believe who picked this as a topic. And then I just kept on like experiencing the pleasure of onboarding, jumping on the movies, you know, bandwagon over and over and over again. I think the first one that really got me is when his mom, like they're in a stultifying kind of ranch house childhood, you know, and the mom and the father at the dinner table, and the father's this nightmare Eisenhower era patriarch. And the mother, you know, with her little permed hair, looks at him and says, "Dear, we agreed it would be best for all of us if you stopped being who you are and doing the thing you love." And I just thought that is the fucking funniest line. And I was there for the rest of it. I'd say two things about its charms. The first is that powerfully one has always felt for this ubiquitous, very silly, you know, just fact of our cultural universe now for like, God, I mean, we're coming up on 50 years, is that this guy would be doing this alone in his house to amuse his kids and his neighbors, right? Like Weird Al's not doing anything that Weird Al doesn't find fun and silly and just nonsensical. And it's just pure juvenile whimsy. And with, I don't know, I sense the absence of cynicism in everything Weird Al does. I hope I'm not wrong. And the second thing I'd say is just personally, there's some, I grew up, and I think Weird Al grew up in a time when, you know, there was still clearly a mainstream in America. It was still dominated by like middle-aged WASP men in you know, demure suits. You know, there was like an establishment and there was a mainstream still. And so being juvenile was being juvenile. It was being freaking juvenile because there was still this construct of the grown-up and the adult. And so I remember I didn't like Dr. Demento. You know, it came on the radio and I didn't really stick with it. But I certainly listened to it. And it was just part of this idea that like on the fringes, the mainstream indulges this weird juvenile, slightly anti-establishment, you know, stuff. And it collapsed. And like the distinction between that margin and the sort of center of culture was lost. And that's when being juvenile, like comedy becomes big comedy and being juvenile becomes monetizable. I think Weird Al has just always transcended that.
You know, the cinematic equivalent, it occurs to me, to that kind of culture, which then became the mainstream because they were so popular, were the Zucker, Abraham Zucker movies, yeah, like sure. Airplane and the Naked Gun movies. And those are clearly a referent here. I mean, here's something that differentiates this from other kind of music biopic parodies, maybe, is that it harks back to that style of humor where there's a gag per minute. There doesn't have to be any logical set of principles tying the reality together, right? And there's just this joyous anarchy. It makes a lot of sense that this would be in that tone since Weird Al himself was in all three of the Naked Gun movies, but it also has that cameo, you know, that incredible proliferation of cameos from those movies. So, I mean, for just a few seconds in this movie, you'll see, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda and Jack Black and who else is in it? Will Forte and Conan O'Brien. Yeah, just and Michael McKean, like every possible sort of comedy staple from, you know, the past few decades just pops up for at least a short appearance. And I mentioned this in my review, but I particularly love the party scene at Dr. Demento's house.
Yeah.
Dr. Demento being played by Rainn Wilson, where just every single kind of comedy face of the 1980s appears,
yeah.
You know,
oh,
played
so
by
good.
some contemporary comic. And Jack Black in particular as Wolfman Jack mm-hmm. just had me on the floor.
That's a really funny scene. Yeah, I agree.
I just came by to lay eyes on this cat you've been parading around. The one who takes pre-existing musical compositions and completely changes the lyrics.
Here, here. Well, it's a weird : the Al Yankovic story. And it's right there on like Roku. Just Google it. You can watch it for free. Nothing arcane about finding it. Do it. It's really fun. Okay, moving on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Well, now is the moment in the podcast we discuss business. Inevitably, Dana, we have some. What would you bring to us?
Just a wee bit, as has been the case lately, our only item of business today is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. So this week, we're back to listener questions. We got a good listener question from a listener named Anne, who wrote to us mainly because she wanted to recommend a podcast called Comfort Eating with Grace Dent. And that sounds like a good recommendation for November, the month of cooking and eating. So we will check that out. But Anne also had a suggestion that the three of us talk about our favorite comfort foods for a Slate Plus segment. She wanted to know what we eat in times of stress. Actually, today, as we're recording, is election day, midterm election, so it's a good stress eating day. We will address that question, our favorite comfort foods, and maybe look toward Thanksgiving and what we cook for comfort in the month of November. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can look forward to hearing that conversation at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. As the members out there know, when you're a member, you get a lot of perks, including ad-free podcasts, bonus segments like the one I just described, which many other shows offer too, and of course, unlimited access to all of the great writing on Slate. When you're a Slate Plus member, you're supporting us, our work, and the work of our brilliant colleagues. These memberships matter a lot for Slate, so please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, Steve, what's next?
All right, well, Dairy Girls. It's a exquisitely small, in one sense, very, very funny coming-of-age story set against the backgrounds of a, you know, huge historical conflict, the Troubles, the low-grade 30-year war that tore apart Ireland, especially Northern Ireland, where our four lovable Irish girls and one boy and English cousin live. They are lovable. They're impish fuck-ups in a very Catholic society going to a very Catholic school. And it's a society whose nerves are frayed by the constant specter of violence, but built into the show from the beginning was an endpoint. They're coming of age and leaving their Catholic high school, what we'd call high school, and the Good Friday agreements, which more or less ended the Troubles. So, and we, you know, one would notice those timelines are set to coincide at the beginning of the show. Anyway, the show is now over. It's ended its third season. It's on Netflix. Let's listen to a clip. Here's one from season two of the show. The girls are about to have a very rare encounter with some Protestant students. It's part of a school field trip, and we're going to hear them prepping for that encounter.
These prods have some serious moves up their sleeves, you know. They're not as fucked up about sex as we are. They've put the work in. They know what they're doing.
They're people, Michelle. They're not the sex toys.
I beg to differ.
I'm really looking forward to making friends with some lads.
Lads aren't going to make friends with you, James. Lads make friends with other lads.
I am a lad.
So you are, James.
Okay, how much money do we have?
Look, the riding of the Protestants is one thing, but I don't see why we have to buy them a present. I mean, they already have all the land, all the jobs, and all the fucking rights.
Hi, Michelle. That's definitely the attitude we should have entering into this weekend.
Julia, if you don't love this television show, you are so dead to me, and dead is forever. Julia, what do you think of Dairy Girls?
No, no pressure. It's really, really enjoyable. I mean, I think we've all been hearing such great things about it for years, and we wanted to visit it and sink into it on the occasion of the series ending. And I get why everyone's been so excited about it. Its tone and its humor are really specific. I mean, it fits into the lineage of kind of a black comedy, gallows humor, the foibles of human life and insecurity and mundane travails continuing to unfold in the context of, you know, chaos, violence, enmity, and deep historical conflict. Like, that's sort of a genre or a type, but you feel absolutely transported in the world. And the thing I'm interested to hear both of you talk about as critics is how the show pulls that off, because the performances are odd. Like, they're not quite naturalistic. They're a bit bent. They're a little bit over much. I mean, actually, I'll take a crack at saying something that will cause you to excommunicate me, Steve. I think the main actress, the one who plays Erin, is like by far the worst actor on the show.
Be careful.
And kind of don't like her performance.
Tread carefully.
But it works because they're all operating at this like slightly oscillating fever pitch. And maybe that's, a commentary on humanity and warfare. I don't know what it is. Why does it work? Why does it work even though the performances are so weird?
I guess I don't understand what you mean by weird. I think that main actress, whose name is Saoirse Monica Jackson, who plays, I guess, sort of the alter ego of Lisa McGee, the creator,
like
right?
It, yeah.
The girl who wants to grow up to be a writer and is incredibly pompous and pretentious about it. I mean, I think she's fantastic.
Yeah,
but it's very much, I saw her performance in one review we read compared to Jim Carrey, you know, early Jim Carrey. She's very rubber-faced. You know, she's not afraid to look ridiculous and sound ridiculous and kind of lampoon her own character.
Teenagers have rights now, you know.
Don't be ridiculous.
They do, Ma. It's true. Sure, Macaulay Culkin might be divorced and has parents.
It's not the kind of person you usually get as the pensive writerly girl at the, you know, at, which is sort of a trope in, you know, movies about or shows about teen girls, right? That there's the pensive writerly one. But this particular pensive writerly one is constantly mocking her own pretensions in a way I found hilarious. But it's true that this movie has a specific tone that makes it able to work, right? I mean, how can it be that there's this 20-minute teen comedy against the background of all this civil strife and violence that doesn't feel like those two things are clashing, you know?
Not at all.
I mean, Lisa McGee herself has said, this is very autobiographical, she did go to an all-girls Catholic school in Derry, Ireland during the Troubles, right? So it's specifically based on things that she's experienced. And yet, it's true that it seems to take place in a world that feels like a sitcom, and that sounds like a put-down, but it's in the best way, right? I mean, every family member in the packed household that Aaron, that main character, lives in is so specifically drawn. And how does the show pull it off exactly? I know one thing that Lisa McGee also said in an interview is that she initially did not set this as a period piece during the Troubles. She just wanted to write a show about teen girls in the present day. And that one of the producers sat down with her and said, well, you have all of this great life experience. Why don't you set it in the past and incorporate this? And her initial response was, oh, but that's going to bring it down. You know, I don't want to make some sort of serious political show. When I was growing up, this was just the world that was around me. And so that's how she wrote it. You know, so this isn't, I think I put off watching this show because I thought, oh, it's going to be depressing and violent and the main characters are going to all be constantly getting, you know, bombed and, you know, tearing each other limb from limb or something. It really is, in tone, a little bit like Reservation Dogs, a show that we all loved, I think, and talked about last year, or like Freaks and Geeks, which it's been compared to. There's something playful and truly teenage about it that just works.
Absolutely. I agree with all of that, Dana. One thing I pick out from what you just said is it, you know, it was just the world that Lisa McGee grew up in. And it was, I think, that made it possible to have it be just the world, quote unquote, just the world in which these characters live and not an occasion for a highly self-conscious, overwrought and occasionally mawkish examination of a very ugly period in history. So it's just there. It's what they're in the midst of. And that's exactly how people live and cope, right? Like they go on. They're ordinary in the face of extraordinary circumstances that others can't believe they even survived. And so here's, I mean, I love so much about the show. It's rapidly approaching Schitt's Creek territory for me. It's like a little wrinkle in a dying world's fabric that I just want to crawl into and never, ever leave, right? But one thing I want to talk about it a little bit is its tone, because Julia, I agree with you in this way, that the tone is very singular. It's jagged, especially at first. I felt like it took some getting used to. It's loud, staccato, jagged. The acting style is very broad, but it somehow, that's kind of to me the point of intersection between they live in a community that's a war zone, and they don't know when the war will break out and how around them. And I think there's a way in which that just is omnipresent, but never quite present. And it's in their affect. And the show is very wise. It never shows you, it never puts in your face how wise it is and how subtle it is. You have to discover those as you go, but when you discover them, the riches are remarkable, because the show's, not only is it very wise about being an adolescent and being in high school, but it's very wise about how nations are like families and families are like nations. You know, that conflict and love are inseparable parts of a single thing in some sense. And I feel strongly, Julia, as though the tonality has something to do with that kind of expressions of affection. I mean, that's very sitcom, right? But here it doesn't feel like a standard sitcom thing where expressions of affection and familiarity often take the form of a kind of put down, right? Or there's a something like that. But there's, for here, it feels earned and quite real. And the ensemble, I mean, the ensemble is just, to my mind, is just amazing.
Can I just shout out somebody who is not a teenager and who absolutely rules in this show? And there must, I am sure there must be entire tumblers about how incredible she is Siobhan McSweeney as Sister George Michael, the head nun at the school. Just this unbelievably funny, how do you describe Sister George Michael? She's really sarcastic and deadpan. She seems incredibly bored with her job. Yet she's also strangely pious and very attached to the religious statues around the school. And suddenly we'll have these little bursts of kind of, you know, this very faith-imbued discourse. You just cannot make out who this person is, but she's never not hilarious.
Yeah, totally agree. And the show, Julia, it's like littered with such performances. The widow or grandfather of the protagonist is an amazing performance who's just constantly ripping on his son-in-law in the most brutalist way, but he's got this slyness and twinkle to him that comes out so judiciously. And the sister, the aunt, is this just wonderful space cadet. And it just, to me, this show, just every single part of it, it just fits into the clock and it just ticks beautifully along. I love it.
I mean, there are so many great performances. That's sort of what brings me back around to the main ensemble, who it works. It definitely works. I love the show. I'm not saying it doesn't, but there's just this like heightened franticness to almost every performance, especially in that core five. They're constantly shrieking at one another. I really think like two of them are excellent actors and the others. I think part of what makes that work, even though it does take you a minute to sink into the tone, is just it has an unusual aspect for a coming of age show on the heightened emotions of adolescence. Like more typically, I think there's almost like a romantic, nostalgic approach in a coming of age show to how the fact that you're having these feelings for the first time and your future is at stake and what is love and what is friendship, like, that, you know, the stakes just all feel so heightened because you've never done any of it before and you don't know what will happen again in the future. And I think more typically, the viewpoint of the show is sympathetic to that. And there's something about the way that this comes together where even though Lisa McGee clearly has deep affection and sympathy and empathy for the experience of these teenagers, she also kind of gets that they're ridiculous, you know? Like she's sort of skewering them or enticing them to do these self-skewering over-the-top performances that weirdly work. And the kind of acknowledgement that adolescence is fundamentally like ridiculous rather than heroic and glorious is part of what makes this feel so special and interesting. And then having that juxtaposed with the political background you've described, Steve, is also part of what makes the whole thing feel like it has so much heft.
Can I also say the use of 90s music is just incredible? Oh, I would listen fabulous. To an album, a soundtrack album of this show any day of the week, like the Cranberries and I don't know who all is on there, just like every sort of 90s girl band you can imagine.
Can I also just say, I played Josh Levine's wonderful one-year episode on the Macarena trend to my kids in the car a couple weeks ago, and I'm now being haunted by the ghost of the Macarena. There was a Macarena scene in After Sun last week. There was a Macarena musical drop in season 3 of Dairy Girls. Like, I think we just might be an all Macarena show now, and then we're going to have to pick our topics accordingly, so be warned.
Oh my God, the scene, it's not the Macarena, but where they're doing the line dance and they're having a loud argument as they're all doing these ridiculous moves in unison is just so good.
It's so good. You can go on Spotify and just put Dairy Girls in the search engine. You'll get multiple playlists derived from the show. All right. All three seasons of Dairy Girls are on Netflix. I love it unreservedly because I have taste and judgment. And so does Cameron, our producer, who's just had this, like, his face is split into the hugest grin for the whole segment. Dana's sprightly glow is that much more warm and nourishing. And then, Julia, what can one say, right? It made the robot vaguely more humanoid. So not a total failure. All right. It's on Netflix. Check it out and shoot us an email. Tell us what you think. Let's move on.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Effectively, money is a system of trust. When I exchange a good or service for it, I trust that the value of the piece of paper you've given me is meaningful, socially meaningful, it's relatively stable. And it has those things because we, the polity, trusts that it's legalized tender, it's properly issued, universally accepted. I will exchange it for a tuna sandwich later and it'll work. This requires intermediaries, though, banks, issuers of credit, makers of money, the Fed, the U.S. Mint, or does it? After the 08 financial crisis, trust in intermediaries collapsed. And lo, in 2008, a pseudonymous person, someone calling himself Satoshi Nakamoto, published a paper sort of maybe inventing crypto, paving the way for a money that is, in theory at least, trust-free, intermediary-free, that's non-national and non-governmental, kind of libertarian, utopian money. Matt Levine is a Bloomberg opinion columnist. He covers finance and he knows what he's doing. He himself worked for Goldman Sachs and has been a lawyer at Wachtell Lipton and a clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals. Matt Levine, thank you for coming on the show. It is great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, you've written a 40,000-word opus explaining very patiently what crypto is. I mean, I want to emphasize this to our listeners. You should seek this out and read this piece. It's definitive. It's a beautifully explained explainer about what crypto is, how it originated, the use of hashing to encrypt and blockchain to verify it. I may be getting some of those terms wrong. Matt, you did in fact explain it as per the title of our episode, like you were explaining it to a golden retriever. Now, can you double down on the impossible? You've already done the impossible once. Can you explain your explainer in 30 seconds?
Probably not. I mean, crypto was invented as a way to send money without trusting intermediaries, right? People didn't, you know, there was a moment in 2008 where people really didn't trust the banks. And there was this idea that we could have a system of money that was kind of libertarian and freed from bank and national control. And that ended up being Bitcoin. And from there, a lot of the ideas at the core of that kind of spun out into other ideas. So the way that Bitcoin worked, you could program a whole computer to work that way. And so, like, there were a lot of ways to do what people call programmable money and to build a whole financial system on the blockchain, which is the sort of method that Bitcoin uses to send money. And there are kind of like further theories about what you can do with it and building a new form of the internet and a new, you know, almost a new form of society. There's a lot of ways to kind of like reinvent the stuff that we do all day on this like new form of database and this new form of this new way of sending money. So that's the basic idea. And you can take it in a lot of different directions, which I tried to do in the course of 40,000 words.
Let's just extend that explainer a little bit, and then we'll go in some of the really wildly interesting directions that you went in from there. But it can't be reproduced costlessly, right, in some sense. So just explain mining a little bit, some sense of how it is that a completely ethereal, non-material thing becomes, in a sense, scarce and therefore valuable.
Yeah, so you're right. Like that's the sort of core problem, is that money essentially in 2022 consists of electronic messages, right? Like the thing that money is like, I tell my bank to send a message to your bank saying that I've paid you some dollars, and your bank updates the database of how many dollars you have, and my bank subtracts some dollars from my account. And these electronic messages, when banks send them, there is a system of trust that allows them to send them in a way that, like, they're not just like creating dollars willy-nilly, right? Like there is, you know, only banks can send those particular messages. Banks are heavily regulated. We trust the banks. There's all this stuff that makes it so that I can't just like give myself $3 billion without anyone noticing. Bitcoin, like the idea there is that you're not going to have banks. You're not going to have regulation. You're not going to have a trusted intermediary who sort of says how many dollars there can be. And so you need some other system. And the sort of clever thing at the core of Satoshi Nakamoto's Bitcoin white paper is that there is a transaction ledger that is maintained by, in a sense, everyone. Everyone in the system, everyone who sort of uses Bitcoin, can contribute to this ledger of how many, of like keeping track of who has Bitcoins and who sends them. And there is, like, that's cool. That's a way to sort of decentralize and disintermediate and get rid of, like, you know, big banks and sort of devolve power to the users of the system. But there's a problem with it, which is that if anyone can do it, then there's a lot of opportunity for mischief, right? If we say that, like, everyone keeps track of the ledger, then I can come in and say, oh no, actually I have 3 billion Bitcoin, like, you're all wrong, right? And then there's like controversy. And when you say, well, you have a majority vote or something, but then I can just like start, you know, put like plug 1,000 laptops into the Bitcoin network, and then I have 1,000 votes to say that I have 3 billion Bitcoin or whatever. So the solution that Satoshi finds is basically like, you can, everyone can vote, or everyone can contribute to the consensus, but they need to show that they have a stake in it. They need to show that they're sort of serious, legitimate actors. And the way you do that, weirdly, is that you waste a lot of energy on it. You like plug in your laptop and you don't just like say, yes, I vote for this transaction. You say, you solve like trivial but complicated math problems over and over again until you get the right answer. And then if you do that, then you win and you get to confirm transactions, and you also get paid for that in Bitcoin. And that's called Bitcoin mining. And the point of mining is kind of twofold. It maintains the ledger of Bitcoin transactions. It makes it so that people can trust that their Bitcoins are, you know, that people actually own the Bitcoins that they're sending. And it also like generates Bitcoin for the miners, so they get paid. And it is in some ways an extremely clever solution to the problem, because it's like, there's no, you know, central party saying you're allowed to, you know, maintain the ledger. There's no regulation. There's no need to like trust the miners. It's all just incentives make it so that the miners will do the right thing and confirm transactions. On the other hand, it's like quite wasteful and sort of bad for the environment for Bitcoin to use as much electricity as, like, you know, people name different countries at different times, but it uses a lot of electricity. And so it's a controversial topic, but it's an interesting kind of thing at the foundation of crypto.
Can I jump in? There's the foundational financial problem that Bitcoin proposes to solve, and there's the true believers who don't want to trust institutions, and then there's the, as you ably and brilliantly describe in the article, kind of set of more usual financial types who are interested in interesting ways to make money who seem to have hopped into the ecosystem. But can I propose there's another foundational problem which I'm interested in talking about your approach to in this article, which is, it seems like a small percentage of the world is obsessed with crypto, believes it's the future, can't stop thinking about it, can't stop talking about it, can't stop trying to invest in businesses and make money off of it. And then there are the rest of us who do not understand it, or why everyone is so excited about it, and for whom the prospect of making an entire alternate money system when the one we have, though flawed, seems fine. You know, I'm interested in the kind of journalistic tactic you've taken here, which is to address an article, I think, to both groups. And I'm curious about sort of how you think about that as a writer, and how you think about the broader media ecosystem surrounding crypto, because, you know, I've sort of been waiting for you to write this article. And my general experience as someone who reads your wonderful newsletter, which is, you know, mostly explaining very vividly and clearly the world of finance. In general, when I'm thinking about the world of finance, I feel a little bit like I'm squinting and looking at a magic eye. And then with crypto, it feels like I've squinted and I've got the magic eye resolved. And what it is another magic eye that I have to then squint and resolve. Like, the puzzle upon puzzle of the comprehension problem is pretty substantial for me. And I'm like used to being able to understand things, and yet I find this very difficult to understand. So much less so after reading your article. So can you talk a little bit about kind of the information economy around crypto and that bifurcation between the insiders and the outsiders, and how you thought about that in terms of writing the piece?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that is very true, but also like very true of the media ecosystem too, where there's a lot written about crypto that is very much from like an insider perspective, in the sense of it assumes a high degree of knowledge. It assumes a really high degree of enthusiasm, not even knowledge, like, but just like, you know, these coins will go up. What's the best way to make them go up the most, you know? And is very like sort of jargony and insidery and unhelpful to normal people. And then there's also a like mainstream ecosystem that is sort of from the perspective of like, you know, this is all scams, but like, let's hand wave at the blockchain, right? I mean, it's hard to know at what level to start talking about these things, right? It's hard to write about some development in crypto without assuming people like know what a blockchain is, and know what Bitcoin is, and know what Ethereum is, and know who Vitalik Buterin is, and all these things, right? And so like one like really appealing thing of doing this for Business Week was just, you can start at the beginning and kind of get to an interesting place, right? Like, you can spend the time to say, okay, like, this section is about what a blockchain is. Once you understand that, you can talk about all these other things that are interesting in crypto. And I do also, I mean, I just think that I am in an interesting position where I find crypto interesting. I spend time reading about it and talking to people about it and thinking about it, but I'm not like a like deeply committed true believer. And I felt like I had the ability to write for both groups, because I'm not really, you know, either a sort of totally dismissive skeptic or a true believer. And I can try to bridge that gap to some extent. And just, there aren't that many people doing that, I think. I mean, there are some, but it's a relatively small space, because as you say, it's like very polarizing, and people either are really into it or really opposed to it, or just really not interested in it.
Matt, as a basically enumerate person whose eyes turn into pinwheels when anything like a math problem appears in a text, I have to congratulate you for coming the closest anyone ever has to explaining terms like Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency, all these things that you really painstakingly build up an understanding up from the ground up in this piece. It's really effective. I have a question about something you don't write about, which you continually allude to throughout this text, which is the colorful characters, as you call them, that Bitcoin has become known for. I mean, that essentially people that are interested in crypto and this kind of investment, you know, as Steve said earlier, tend to not trust the financial system, tend to be people who consider themselves in some way kind of marginal to the traditional way of thinking about finance, and often marginal in other ways as well. And you briefly allude, as you go through, almost in a joking way, like, here's another colorful character that we're not going to discuss because we're focusing here on understanding the actual concepts. Without having to get into those individual biographies, I just wanted to hear you on whether you think the conversation about cryptocurrency in part continues to sound cryptographic to everyone who's outside that world, because the coverage tends to focus on these crazy characters. And we, you know, so that we start to think of it as something that is more about, you know, these maverick investor outsiders than about anything that could actually apply to our financial lives.
Yeah. I mean, my experience is that's often true of other things too, right? I mean, like in finance, and in tech coverage, there's a lot of focus on colorful personalities because, like, that has just sort of an obvious human interest. I think that it is probably easier to write a story about, you know, how did the financial crisis affect your mortgage than it is to write a story about how did Bitcoin affect your mortgage, because one did affect your mortgage and one didn't, right? So, like, there's a sort of obvious hook to writing structural stories about tech or finance because people use those things every day or interact with them in an obvious way. Whereas if you don't want to interact with crypto, you really don't ever have to interact with crypto.
Matt, I came away from the piece with three takeaways, and I want to kind of read them back to you so you can tell me if I've properly apprehended the 40,000 words here. So takeaway one, the fact that crypto all crashed doesn't mean those of us who don't understand it can just stop squinting at the magic eye and forget about it because it doesn't matter anymore. It's here and the seeds are set and it's going to continue being important. So it's worthwhile to try to figure it out. Takeaway two was what I took to be the thing that you find most interesting about crypto. You write, this is a key financial innovation of crypto. Crypto built an efficient system to make the customers of a business also its shareholders. And the notion of kind of using the decentralization to empower the users of a product to benefit from it and profit from it rather than a very small group of rich people. I could see why that would be exciting and why you singled that out. The final takeaway that you describe at the end that landed with me is the notion that there is this massive, 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 like value obliterating crash, you know, mere months ago. And because one of the main problems with crypto and one of the things that seeds the information economy around it is that half the world understand, well, maybe not half, some chunk of the world understands and is passionate about it and deeply invested in it. And the rest of us can go happily along, like accumulating points on our target cards and paying for things in cash like chumps. It means that crash only affected the people who were already invested and it didn't kind of ruin the rest of our lives in the way that the 2008 crash did. But you kind of intimate that maybe that kind of thin, slim, slender connection between the crypto world and the real world isn't actually going to get firmer. It's just going to mean that crypto gets more valuable once we all live in the metaverse. And you say you're not going to explain the metaverse, but that it's like a virtual currency for virtual lives that we're supposedly headed towards if we believe in Mark Zuckerberg. So that's, I guess my question to you is, did I get that right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. So a couple of points. One, on the first point about, you know, we still need to pay attention to it. Like, I still need to pay attention to it because I read about finance. It's possible that, I think possible outcome for crypto is that a lot of the claims that people make about it being important in real life are false. Some of them are going to be true. And, like, people do, you know, use Bitcoin to, like, send remittances to sort of difficult to bank, you know, countries. But like a lot of them are going to be false and a lot of them were sort of just hype. And what people are definitely building is financial infrastructure. And like one possibility is that in 10 years, a lot of stocks will be traded on sort of crypto rails, crypto exchanges will sort of take over some amount of financial infrastructure. And you won't think about that much more than you think about, you know, the computers at the stock exchange today. And that a lot of what is happening here is sort of hype and exposure for what is essentially a technological infrastructure that might matter to people, might make the financial industry more efficient, might make it easier to do certain kinds of like financial transactions, but that won't like, you know, dominate your life. That you won't think about that much. I think that's one real possibility. And that sort of gets to the other question. I mean, yes, like something like $2 trillion of value is erased from crypto and somebody therefore is, you know, some people are therefore poorer by $2 trillion, but you almost don't notice it. And I think a lot of the reason for that is that this was all, you know, a lot of this was people who had made a lot of funny money really quickly and were like, oh, wow, I'm a 100 millionaire on paper. And then the next day they were a 30 millionaire and they're like, oh, that's still great. You know, who cares? It's not you know, people putting their life savings into this, because a lot of the stuff was sort of very obviously very speculative, and so you weren't putting your life savings into making big levered bets on Bitcoin going up. Now, some people were, and like there were, you know, and often there's like a sort of like fraud or mismarketing element to that, but for the most part, this was kind of all speculative, and when it went down, it was fine. And then, you know, the question is, will it be more integrated into real life such that like the next time there's a big crypto crash, that'll matter to people who are not crypto enthusiasts? And the answer is maybe, right? Like, I do think that like crypto, it is somewhat hard for crypto to interface with the real world. It is easier for it to interface with the internet. And, you know, the more that you know, internet becomes the default method of payment for things, and the more that we spend time, you know, on Zoom and video games rather than in real life, the more opportunities there are for crypto to actually matter. But then also, you know, the point I made about building a financial system, if crypto people do a good job of building like the rails for a financial system, then a crypto crash will just matter more. Like if you're getting your mortgage, you know, indirectly from a crypto thing, then like you'll want crypto prices to stay high. Just like if you're getting your mortgage from a bank in 2008, you wanted banks to do well, even though you didn't like really care personally about banks. But like it turned out that when banks did poorly, that affected you.
Mm. All right. Well, unfortunately, we have to go. We've gone over. I could talk about this eternally, but I have to point out one wonderful irony, if I've got it right, from what you just said. The guy looking at his crypto pile and saying that was 100 million, now it's 30 million. 30 million what? In order to give it any kind of, as it were, currency, it is going to be translated for the time being into US dollars, right? It just doesn't yet have that social, it hasn't achieved that social saturation point where it's a thing in itself quite yet. Anyway, Matt, a huge pleasure having you on the show, and the piece is just a triumph, and you know, really everyone should seek it out. So, you know, huge congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Hey, Steve, can I just jump in before we endorse to say one thing?
Of course.
So last week we put out a call to you, dear listeners, to hop onto the Apple Podcast app or your podcast listening app of choice and to rate and review us. And the reason we did that is because podcasting is an ecosystem that favors the new, which is exciting for podcast discovery. All of the various algorithms and apps tend to surface exciting new things you might want to learn about. And we all benefit from that because that's how we discover new stuff. But it means that it can be harder for people to discover old favorites like us, the grizzled veterans of the podcast verse, nearly 15 years into our yakking history. Mm-hmm. So last week we asked some of you to rate and review us, which can help people discover us. And lo and behold, 15 of you chimed in with wonderful ratings and reviews on just the podcast app alone. So I'm seconding the charge. Please do this. It really, really will help us if you value the show and enjoy what you hear here. Just taking a minute to do that can help other people discover the show. Thank you.
Yeah, hear. I think that's a great idea. It really does help us out. All right, Dana, what you got?
Steve, I want to endorse something that I saw, a movie that I saw a couple weeks ago that is one of the best movies I've seen this year, and I absolutely love it, but I was a little hesitant to endorse it at first because I'm not sure how many of our listeners will be able to watch it. I guess that depends on where you're listening from and what the distribution plan ends up being for this movie, but it is one of the best documentaries of the year for sure, so just to keep your eye out for it. It is playing, I know, right now in New York at Film Forum, probably showing in LA as well, and will be opening throughout the fall in other places, but keep your eyes open for this Hindi language documentary called All That Breathes. Have either of you seen any trailers or heard anything about All That Breathes?
No.
So,
isn't this a bird documentary?
Yes, Julia, it's so up your alley because it is about,
I am excited for that.
It is about bird rescuers. It's a documentary about two brothers and their friend in Delhi who have opened or are trying to open a kind of freelance bird rescue out of their apartment. And I don't want to give too much away about what happens over the course of the movie, but essentially they find injured kites, birds of prey, that are hovering constantly over Delhi, in part because of the huge piles of garbage and refuse that are everywhere. So it's also a movie in some ways about climate change and the pollution of that city. But these two brothers just love birds of prey. They're not vets or professionals in any way, but they want to learn more about that world, and they just bring birds home and kind of create this shelter for them before releasing them back into the environment. But as the title All That Breathes suggests, it's really a documentary in a way about animal life and human life coexisting, and it's very contemplative, pretty slow moving, but in a great way. So for now, this movie is only in theaters, and I don't think that it's even in broad release yet, but it is an HBO production. So keep your eye on HBO. I suspect that it will go on streaming on HBO sometime in 2023. It's called All That Breathes, and it's directed by Shaun Aksen, and it's just a beautiful movie.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Julia, what do you have?
Well, in a slight tonal shift, I'd like to recommend an Instagram account, and that Instagram account is by the name of Hot Dads of Picture Books. And it is what it says. It's basically somebody curating pictures of smoke show dads from picture books. And it's kind of a new account. Doesn't actually have it. It's got about 10,000 followers. I can't attest to its future longevity or really anything, but I appreciate its commitment to the bit. It puts some dads in the grid and others in stories. Don't know why. And I think the reason why I enjoy it is not so much because of a particular aesthetic appreciation for the hot dads, but because now that I am back in the picture book trenches reading picture books to my daughter, I have this kind of remembrance of how I felt when I was still in that phase with my older sons who are now 9, which is if you have any kind of like literary critical mind and you spend hours per week reading picture books, some of which are brilliant and some of which are absolute dreck, you're just like, where is the critical discourse about picture books? Like, I must engage with other minds about these texts. And then it's like nowhere. It's like dance, you know? It's like there's no criticism of it anymore. And you don't, if you want someone to help shape your thinking on it. So
try living with somebody who makes picture books. You'll hear about them nonstop, day and night, the highest theoretical elaboration.
Maybe. Yeah, your partner should follow this account, and maybe he and I should just hop on the phone some point. Because I can't say that Hot Dads of Picture Books is criticism at all. It's just attention. It's just attention paid to this form that is massively influential, that is now back in my brain grapes for, you know, a couple more years, and I'm savoring it and dreading it and loving it and reading the anarchic mischief of Good Dog Carl like 16 times in a row again. And man, that's a brilliant book, actually. No dads in that book, hot or otherwise. But anyway, just I see you people out there who are paying attention to picture books, and Hot Dads of Picture Books is a pretty amusing little account.
All right. Well, the shift the tone once again. The really wonderful Mimi Parker, who is the drummer vocalist of the band, indie band Low, has died this past Saturday. She and her life partner, her husband, Alan Sparhawk, formed this band almost 30 years ago. And, you know, they're just very distinctive sound, like incredibly low, slow, quiet rock and roll that has this, you know, incantatory quality to it, and it tends to, it withholds a lot, but also builds. It's not energyless. I love their music. And so I'm endorsing both Lowe, who I think people should seek out, but also very much The Remembrance, written by Sam Adams, Slate's own Sam Adams, and a very good friend of this program, the indie rock drummer. It's up on Slate now. The indie rock drummer who taught me that making art matters no matter what. And you know, the thing is, they just didn't sell records, right? They had a certain fan base that was very loyal to them, showed up for them. But they were just interested in doing what they did. They lived in Duluth, Minnesota. They both raised Mormons, might have even been practicing Mormons. And they made this crazy, wonderful, spooky rock and roll music. Check them out and check out the Sam Adams piece on Slate, Remembering Her and the Band. It's a wonderful piece of writing. Julia, thank you so much. That was good show. Really fun.
Thank you, Steve.
Dana, as always, a real pleasure.
Such a pleasure.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by Nicholas Bertel, the composer, and our production assistant is Jessica Balderrama. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.